Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. Today is September 24th, 2005. There's a lot happening today, and we're going to be focusing on both the anti-war activities happening in Washington, D.C. today and around the country, and also looking more closely at some of the underreported stories about Hurricane Katrina. We'll also be speaking with Tom Jackson of Joe Public Films, who will be calling in from the march in Washington, D.C. But first, the news. This is Steve Diamond with some news. Our first story is from the Associated Press. Sheehan's anti-war campaign is now in D.C. Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan pledged Wednesday to, quote, force change to happen during protest speeches outside the White House and the Capitol. Sheehan arrived in Washington after a three-week cross-country bus tour that began near President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. She's expected to participate in an anti-war rally Saturday that organizers hope will draw tens of thousands of people. Sheehan, whose 24-year-old son, Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, was killed last year in Iraq, and wants Bush to explain why he sent the United States to war and say what steps he will take to end the conflict. She said, "This is where we will force change to happen, because we, the people of America, are the checks and balances on this government, and we will end this war." Later, Bush paid tribute to the mothers of military men and women who have died in the line of duty. He proclaimed Sunday to be Gold Star Mother's Day and instructed that the U.S. flag be flown over government buildings. He also urged Americans to display the flag as well. He said, "On Gold Star Mother's Day, we recognize and pray for the devoted and patriotic mothers of those men and women in uniform who have made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of our liberty," the president said in his proclamation. Gold Star Families for Peace, which was co-founded by Sheehan, planned to begin airing television ads that would run on CNN in Washington and Fox News Channel nationwide for several weeks, beginning Thursday. The group Win Without War purchased ads for Thursday's edition of 14 newspapers, including the Washington Post, the Denver Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and USA Today. And our next story from PR Web. Soldiers back from Iraq support Cindy Sheehan's anti-war stance on video.google.com. Anti-war statements from U.S. soldiers who have served in the Iraq War appear online now at video.google.com. Metropole Filmworks, LLC, has been recording interviews with soldiers who have returned from Iraq since March. The footage collected will be used in their upcoming documentary called Back from Iraq, The Citizen Soldier Speaks. They have posted clips from several interviews online in order to make sure that congressional representatives and the general public are aware that Cindy Sheehan speaks for many, many soldiers when she says the war in Iraq must be brought to a swift conclusion. In one clip, Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Macy, retired, describes the killing of more than 20 unarmed protesters in the first days of the initial assault on Iraq, and the subsequent killing of many more unarmed Iraqis at a military checkpoint. Jimmy Macy, previously a Paris Island trainer and recruiter for the U.S. Marines, described how, when he told his commanding officer, quote, "Today's been a bad day, sir. We've killed a lot of civilians," his commanding officer responded, "No, today is a good day." Macy adds, "When he said that, I realized I was in the wrong place. Maybe I wasn't cut out for the Marine Corps." In another clip, Patrick Resta, a Pennsylvania National Guardsman serving as U.S. Army medic, describes how he and fellow medics were prevented from providing medical care to desperate Iraqi civilians who approached them for help because their own hospitals had been devastated by the war. He also describes how, in violation of the Geneva Conventions regarding medics, he was required to carry a rifle. He said, quote, "I walked an oil pipeline for 2 days in 140-degree heat to keep it from being sabotaged and blown up. How dare you tell me this war isn't about oil?" What these clips make clear is that there are soldiers fulfilling their obligations to the U.S. military who do not support the war in Iraq. They feel their service in Iraq is a direct conflict with their commitment to, quote, "protect and defend the United States." Jeff Key, Lance Corporal in the U.S. Marine Corps, is currently serving as Cindy Sheehan's bodyguard. In his clip, he makes it clear that he is not a pacifist. He became a Marine to protect and defend defenseless people. He says, "I'm sick to death of being told how much better the Iraqis' lives are." He suggests that if the people of the United States were offered a solution to all the nation's troubles, ranging from health care to education, at the price the Iraqis have been asked to pay, they wouldn't accept the offer. What if someone came to us and said, "We're going to fix all these problems. The only thing is, we're going to kill tens of thousands of you." Metropole Filmworks will be putting DVDs containing soldiers' statements in the hands of elected representatives during anti-war protests led by Cindy Sheehan. Anyone looking for the truth of what's happening in the ground in Iraq has to start with the soldiers who have spent months or years there. Metropole Filmworks will be posting additional clips of soldiers talking about their service in Iraq in the weeks to come. And our next story from Yahoo News. Support for Bush Iraq policy dives after Katrina. From Reuters. U.S. public support for Iraq policy has nosedived in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, but this seems unlikely to force the administration to change tack, political analysts said on Wednesday. Katrina has changed many things, but I don't think it will change Iraq policy. There's almost no elasticity in that policy, said Daniel Pletka of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, an acknowledged supporter of both Bush and his Iraq policy. Political scientist Carl Gilson of the Southern Methodist University agreed. He said, "There's no way back for Bush on Iraq. He can't run away from that policy. He has to secure something he can plausibly point to as a success." Public support for the president on Iraq has been gradually eroding in the past year as the U.S. military death toll mounted towards 2000 and little progress was made in stopping a bloody insurgency that began soon after the 2003 invasion. But backing for its policy, that U.S. troops will stay until Iraqis can establish a government and army that can govern and defend itself, has dropped dramatically since Katrina devastated Louisiana and Mississippi. A Gallup poll published on Monday found 66% of respondents favored the immediate withdrawal of some or all of the U.S. troops in Iraq, a 10% point jump in just 2 weeks. Bush's personal approval on Iraq fell from 40% to 32% in the same period. In a CBS New York Times poll the previous week, 75% said Bush had no clear plan for bringing U.S. troops home. Republicans in Congress, who know they face difficult midterm elections in November 2006, are becoming increasingly concerned about their prospects. "The mood up here among Republicans is very, very sour," said one staffer who did not want to be named. Congress has already approved $62.3 billion for recovery and reconstruction after Katrina, and the eventual cost could reach $200 billion or more. The Iraq War and occupation have cost over $200 billion so far. The United States is spending $5.6 billion a month there, or almost $186 million a day. Some Republicans, like Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, had been arguing, even before the hurricane hit, that the current Iraq policy was unsustainable. He said, "We are seen as occupiers. We are targets. We've got to get out. I don't think we can sustain our current policy, nor do I think we should," he said in an interview last month. More and more Republicans may break with the president in coming months if U.S. casualties continue to mount in Iraq and the country seems no nearer to stability. But the party as a whole had little choice other than to stick with Bush, said political scientist David Birdsell of Baruch College in New York City. Democrats, who up to now have been reluctant to criticize the Iraq policy for fear of seeming unpatriotic, may also feel more able to do so. So far, the Democrats have been cowardly and unwilling to speak out. They need to do so if they want to reap the political benefits of Bush's unpopularity, said Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, a liberal think tank which opposed the Iraq invasion and occupation. And our next story, top Democrats won't attend anti-war rally in Washington, from Knight Ridder. As the anti-war movement arrives in Washington this weekend, many top Democrats are leaving. Nationally known Democratic war critics, including Howard Dean, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York, Russell Feingold of Wisconsin, and John Kerry of Massachusetts, won't attend what sponsors say will be a big anti-war rally Saturday in Washington. The only Democratic officeholders who plan to attend the rally are Representatives Cynthia McKinney of Georgia and John Conyers of Michigan. Today's leading Democrats had a party divided over the war, and many leaders are wary of standing with anti-war activists who represent much of the party's base. The divide between anti-war activists and Democratic leaders underscores a challenge the party faces in the 2006 congressional elections and beyond. Some activists say that Democrats such as Clinton and Kerry, who criticized the war but refused to demand a timetable for withdrawal, are effectively supporting the status quo and may not merit future support. En route to Washington for the rally, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan protested outside Clinton's New York office with about 500 cheering supporters and said, "Hillary Clinton knows that the war is a lie, but she is waiting. You say it, or you are losing your job." Spokesmen for the Democrats who are skipping the anti-war event all say they had schedule conflicts, but some leading anti-war activists aren't buying it. "There are a lot of people here who are wondering, where are the Democrats?" said Tom Andrews, a former Democratic House member from Maine who's now the national director of Win Without War. "The Democratic Party has an identity crisis on this issue. We need voices, we need leadership," Andrews said, "but fear is driving them." The rally comes at a time when a growing number of Americans want a timetable for withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq, a proposition that both President Bush and many leading Democrats reject. A poll this week by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center found that 57% of Americans want to set a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. At the same time, a growing number of grassroots Democrats are dissatisfied with their party's leadership in Congress. The percentage of Democrats who are happy with their leaders dropped from 64% in May to 49% now, the Pew survey found. Kerry planned to be in his home state this weekend, a spokeswoman said. At Brown University on Monday, the senator ripped Bush's conduct on the war, saying the president should admit, quote, countless mistakes in the war and proclaimed that, quote, real leadership stands up to special interests and sets the course for future generations. Russell Feingold was scheduled to be out of town, a spokesperson said. Feingold is the only national Democrat weighing a 2008 presidential campaign who's endorsed setting a timetable to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq. Our job is to make them pay a price for continuing to support this war, said Bill Dobbs, a spokesman for United for Peace and Justice, another group that's organizing the anti-war weekend in Washington. 66 members of Congress have formed an out-of-Iraq congressional caucus that wants either immediate withdrawal or a timetable to withdraw. None of the party's congressional leadership and none of the likely candidates for president are members. And our next story, Karzai wants an end to U.S.-led operations, from the Associated Press. Afghan President Hamid Karzai challenged the need for major foreign military operations in Afghanistan, saying airstrikes are no longer effective and that U.S.-led coalition forces should focus on rooting out terror bases and support networks. His call for a new approach to tackling militants came despite the fiercest fighting in Afghanistan since U.S.-led forces invaded in late 2001. Karzai demanded an immediate end to foreign troops searching people's homes without his government's authorization. He also said foreign governments should, quote, concentrate on where terrorists are trained, on their bases, on the supply to them, on the money coming to them, a veiled reference to support that militants allegedly get from neighboring Pakistan. Afghan officials have repeatedly accused Pakistan of aiding Taliban rebels and other militants, a charge Islamabad vehemently denies. I don't think there is a big need for military activity in Afghanistan anymore, Karzai told reporters. The nature of the war on terrorism in Afghanistan has changed now. It was the second time Karzai has publicly challenged the U.S.-led coalition. In May, before a trip to Washington, he demanded more authority over the 20,000-member U.S.-led coalition there, but President Bush said they would remain under American control. In addition to the coalition troops, there are 11,000 NATO peacekeepers in Afghanistan. And next, from the Christian Science Monitor and the AP. Disaster relief? Call in the Marines. Bush suggests lifting the ban on using the military domestically. President Bush suggested a larger disaster relief role for the armed forces in his national address, and Congress will address the issue soon. Though the topic has emerged at other troubled times, most recently 9/11, Congress has always avoided mentioning posse comitatus. Anger over the scenes of chaos in New Orleans in the days after the hurricane, however, seems to have shifted the political landscape. It is an issue of profound importance both to the Pentagon and to the country at large, raising questions about the boundaries between the armed forces and American society, as well as the military's ability to press the war on terror abroad if it receives a new homeland mission. In his Thursday address, Mr. Bush called the armed forces, quote, the institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice. As of yet, he has simply stated that, quote, a challenge on this scale requires a broader role for the armed forces. Yet even before Bush's address, Senator John Warner of Virginia, a Republican, wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld saying that the Senate Armed Service Committee would be looking into, quote, the entire legal framework governing a president's power to use the regular armed forces to restore public order in a large-scale, protracted emergency, and asking Mr. Rumsfeld to do the same. This framework rests on posse comitatus, as well as the Insurrection Act, which together bar active-duty troops from engaging in domestic law enforcement activities unless there is essentially an open rebellion. Reservations about granting the military too much power at home are older than the Republic itself, harkening back to the days when British soldiers were foisted upon colonials for room and board. In the Constitution, the framers made specific provisions to check military power by declaring that America's armed forces be directed by civilian authority, namely, the various secretaries of defense. Posse comitatus goes even further, giving only National Guard units the authority to act as law enforcement, because they are under the control of governors. Active duty troops are being used in the Gulf relief efforts, but only for humanitarian efforts and logistical support. The move to amend posse comitatus would likely give them law enforcement powers. Yet the military has traditionally been among the strongest opponents, wary of any move that would take training time or money away from its fundamental mission, preparing for and waging war. If you create within the Department of Defense a primary mission to respond to these sorts of events, you're creating a huge additional burden, says retired Major General Bruce Lehler of the Joint Task Force Civilian Support. The focus begins to shift, and that's not good. The first step would likely be the amending of posse comitatus, and civil libertarians, too, worry that any change could be rash and misguided. After 9/11, the government immediately leapt to the conclusion that there was a lack of power, so it passed the Patriot Act, said Timothy Edgar of the American Civil Liberties Union. Changing the law in a way that threatens civil liberties isn't the answer to a problem of management.
There was a time in this fair land when people had to take a stand to break the chains of tyranny. This time it's up to you and me. There was a time in this fair land, once more the flames of war were fanned to bring an end to slavery. This time it's up to you and me. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to raise your voice. You have the right to disagree. Don't be afraid to make a choice. There was a time in this fair land, the workers fought the boss's plans and took back their humanity.
They took back their humanity.
This time it's up to you and me. There was a time in this fair land, strangers marched hand in hand to topple Jim Crow bigotry.
They topple Jim Crow bigotry.
This time it's up to you and me. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to raise your voice. You have the right to disagree. Don't be afraid to make a choice. Time in this fair land to draw a line in the sand and defend our liberty.
Defend our liberty.
Friends, it's up to you and me. Now is the time in this fair land to join together in one band and take back our democracy.
Yes, take back our democracy.
Friends, it's up to you and me. We have the right to remain silent. We have the right to raise our voice. We have the right to disagree. We're not afraid to make a choice. Don't be afraid to raise your voice. 'Cause friends, it's up to you and me. This time it's up to you and me.
That was This Fair Land by Graham and Barbara Dean. The following is my latest column on nhindymedia.org called Between a Rack and a Hard Place, the latest one being Occupying Ourselves. You can find this on nhindymedia, that's www.nhindymedia.org. Like failed U.S. policy in Iraq and Vietnam before it, military occupation, suspension of rights, and massive force are the strategies of choice to deal with crises, including Hurricane Katrina. 4 years ago, at the launch of the War on Terror, we were told that the purpose of the war was to, quote, defend freedom, and that justice will be done. Freedom and justice are certainly ideals worth fighting for, while fighting for oil and strategic influence, for instance, might not be seen as a good enough reason. Fighting for mom and apple pie was a similarly useful metaphor during World War II. There is little doubt that freedom and justice are under attack on all fronts, but the threat is not from a faceless coward, as Bush claimed. I recognize that face, even if he doesn't. Bush himself is engaged in a war on American civil liberties in the name of protecting us from an enemy that supposedly wants to kill us for our freedoms. The real question comes down to who we are, and if justice means fairness and due process for all, or simply a bureaucratic hierarchy designed to serve the needs of just us, the privileged few. Eugene Debs, former socialist presidential candidate, once said, "Years ago I recognized my kinship with all living things, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on the earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free." For words such as those, and for speaking against the draft, Debs was sentenced to 10 years in prison and stripped of his citizenship. He learned the hard way that the only freedoms we truly have are those tested in practice in times of great conflict. Even well before 9/11, military exercises invading U.S. cities suggested that the ruling class has found the enemy, and it is us. In Charlotte, North Carolina, dozens of Army Special Forces and Black Hawk helicopters flew into a neighborhood, guns blazing, simulating a counterterrorism raid. In the past few years, citizens exercising free speech in Boston, New York, and throughout the country have been confined in protest pens out of sight of the officials being protested, sometimes ringed with barbed wire and military police. An appeals court has also just ruled that President Bush has the authority to hold a U.S. citizen indefinitely without charge, the same treatment that Homeland Security has already routinely given to non-citizens living in this country. Unknown thousands of other people have also been detained for questioning. In this context of rising totalitarianism in America, the administration's inept management of the Katrina disaster that has killed primarily African Americans and poor people in New Orleans is now being followed by martial law and forced relocation. All legally registered firearms are being confiscated from private citizens, but the authorities are ignoring the heavily armed private guards defending corporate property. Our civil rights are at times inconvenient and easily dispensed with by the ruling class. The U.S. government habitually has one strategy at its disposal for crises at home and abroad: massively overwhelming firepower. Such an imposed peace is really no peace at all, and certainly makes a farce of justice imposed under the boots of those sworn to uphold the law and defend the Constitution. Once again, you can find that commentary at nhindymedia.org.
My name is Scooter, welcoming you to The Inner Side. And this week's program is going to focus a lot on other media, things from other media, for reasons I will explain shortly. In that spirit, I'd like to share something that I heard on The Daily Show last week. It's that real news program they have on television. I watch it online because we don't have cable, because we have children, so. The author Kurt Vonnegut was a guest on the program last week, and he had something very interesting to say in reference to our nation-building adventures in the Middle East. So I would like to share that with you in paraphrase right now. Mr. Vonnegut said, "If we are going to export U.S.-style democracy to Iraq, it's a long process and we're going to have to be careful to follow up. We have to make sure that in 100 years from now, they free their slaves. And in 150 years from now, they allow their women to vote. But as far as ethnic cleansing and widespread genocide, they're probably going to have to get a little busier if they're going to emulate U.S.-style democracy." Kurt Vonnegut from the TV set, of all places, opining on the Baghdad Tea Party.
This whole thing was totally botched. I mean, such a slow response. The price of gas waited 2 days after the storm to jump to over $3 a gallon.
Now, wait a minute, Stanger.
Now, that's ridiculously slow. What kind of a country is this?
Stanger, you're thinking very, very crudely. You're not getting the finer points of this.
Hey, FEMA is opening a restaurant chain.
FEMA.
FEMA, that you drive up to the window and place your order, and 72 hours later, it's ready.
People are dying. They don't have homes. They don't have jobs. The city of New Orleans will never be the same. Now get off your ass and let's do something. And let's fix the biggest goddamn crisis in the history of this country. 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 Country.
Does it gotta come down to this? In order to see things for what they are, for what it is. We still might not be free up in this piece or treated very equally as far as I can see. Now, if you saw what I saw and see what I see on that TV, it led me to write this song after talking to my father. But the anger in this song seemed to write his damn self. Hell no, we ain't all right.
What is boy, son of a bushman? Nerdin'.
It's simple, it's racial.
Now all these press conferences, breaking news alert, this just in.
while your government looks forewarned to win. Blame for the blame game, names where I begin. Walls closing and get some help to my kin. Who cares? While the rest of the Bush nation stares as the drama unfolds as we the people under the stairs. 50% of this son of a Bush nation is like hating on hating and setting up assassinations. Ask Pat Robertson, quiz him.
Smells like terrorism.
Racism in the news, still one-sided views. Saying white's fine food. Pray for the National Guard who be ready to shoot. Because they be saying us blacks loot.
New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no,
we ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no,
we ain't alright. New Orleans in the morning, afternoon, and night.
Hell no,
we ain't alright.
That was Public Enemy.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
You are tuned in to Voices from the Prison Action Network, produced by the Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. I'm Judith Brink. With us today by phone is a man who's going by the name of Squeaky, speaking to us from Houston, Texas. Welcome to the program, Squeaky. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm doing fine.
Well, you have a pretty amazing story to tell us. You had just begun a jail sentence in Orleans Parish Prison when the hurricane hit.
And I wouldn't sentence. I had just went to jail.
Yeah.
Like 3-4 days before the hurricane.
And what happened after the hurricane hit?
Well, once the hurricane came, the power and everything went out, and we got locked in the cells. We couldn't get out of the cells because the power went out.
And the power controlled the doors?
Yeah, that would control the doors. So we had to sit in the cells like 3-4 days without eating and drinking no water until we did escape the cells. Then we had to excavate just to break out the system, just to find a way out of the jailhouse.
Did the guards and the staff say anything to you when they left?
Well, once the water went to getting high and stuff, they thought they were going to be able to get everybody because they said it was going to come back. But nobody never came back for us. So we just left us there.
And the water kept getting higher?
Well, so from our side, the water was all the way up to like the second floor, and we was on the third floor.
Wow. So were there prisoners down on the first floor?
Oh, no, we didn't go that far. When we got out, we just stood on the third floor, on all over helping, trying to help other inmates escape, you know what I'm saying, get out of their cells.
And how did you get out of your cells?
Well, we used pieces of metal. We broke up our locker boxes, and we just kept prying through the cell, kicking the cells and stuff like that, knocking the cells out of track. And once they get out of track, we'll freeze on out the cells.
Was there a state of panic and hysteria, or were people just steadily doing what they needed to do?
A lot of people panicked. A lot of people were scared. A lot of people still got left behind. You know, a lot of people who did get out of the cells still couldn't escape because they couldn't swim.
Oh. So not everybody made it?
No, not from my understanding. A lot of people, when I left, there was still a lot of people still locked in these cells. a lot of people still was locked. A lot of people still out there still. They didn't want to come because he couldn't swim. They were scared to get in the water and stuff.
Oh, my goodness. So, but you got out of your cell, and yeah. You're not afraid of water.
Well, I knew how to swim.
You knew how to swim. Yeah. So, did you leave?
I really didn't know it was that bad until I hit the water. When I hit the water, only thing I knew it was a bad thing because how high it was. And the water was, it was full of air and gas, the teeth. All your body was air and gas when you came out. Once I could get out of the water, we swam like 4 or 5 hours just to get to the highway. Once we hit the highway, we slept on the highway for like 2-3 days. Wow. Then we found us a boat, and we pedal on a boat from the highway to Jefferson Parish, and then we slept on a bridge for another day before we got on a FEMA bus to bring us here.
So, how many of you were together? You and some other men swam. Were there any women in this prison?
Not in the part that we was in. No. It was me and 2 more dudes who escaped together. One of the dudes, he hurt himself. He cut his leg open while he was swimming. Mm-hmm. So the boat picked him up and brought him straight to the Superdome that they had medical. They had doctors and stuff in the Superdome.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't taking everybody because they gave us life jacket and they just took him because he was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how he split. Me and him split up. And I split up with the other dude like 2 days ago when I phoned my family up. I was in Willow, Texas, I believe. It was Willow, Texas.
And you got taken there by a FEMA bus?
Yeah. And I phoned my family like 2 days ago. It was in Houston, so I called a Greyhound bus from Willow, Texas to Houston, Texas when I phoned my family.
And how many, were your family worried about you?
Yeah, everybody was split up and everybody was still connecting with each other.
Uh-huh.
So, it's still not everybody. We talked to everybody, but most likely everybody's like in Texas, but different part of Texas.
What an adventure. My goodness. What are your strongest emotions about the whole thing?
Passing dead bodies up and stuff like that. And I didn't know where my family was. I didn't know where anybody was.
Mm.
So I didn't find out where everyone was until I called to Ogden. I called my son, Mom. And she connected with my family here in Houston.
Well, you're lucky that you remembered her phone number, number one.
Yeah.
And were able to get a hold of a phone.
Yeah, at the shelter they gave us. At the shelter out there in Willow, Texas.
Uh-huh.
They would let us use the phone.
Okay.
So I called her and she was calling me back. That Sunday, right after church, we went to church. And right after the church, they called me. And it was time for us tickets to go to Ogden. And I was getting ready to go to Ogden, but it was going to be another 2 days on a bus.
Uh-huh.
So when she told my family that Houston, I just kind of planned. I just came to Houston since I was already here in Texas with my family. So,
mm-hmm.
And she's going to be down here to come get me sometime this week.
Mm. Was your impression that there were a lot of people helping and saving people and coming to rescue people, or do you think the situation was pretty bad? And
well, it was a lot of people, you know what I'm saying, like helicopters were saving people, getting people out of the roof and stuff, but when the helicopters get us there, they only just drop it off on the highway.
Oh, okay.
Because, we had to squig our way off the highway when FEMA buses came.
Uh-huh.
And that's how a lot of people get to leave New Orleans when the buses come. But it was the helicopters were just taking people, it was just fine. The helicopters and the boat, it was just helping people escape their homes and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did you see people who were not, who were crying for help and not getting it?
It was a lot of people crying for help, but it was only so many people they could drive on a boat at one time.
Yeah. And were these most...
The boats was picking up most of the people who had kids with them first.
I see.
So when we found our boat, I decided just to pedal on myself. You know what I'm saying? It was me and one other dude who I've been with, and we found two more people to come with us, and we just pedal our way out ourselves. Because we didn't want to keep waiting. Because there was a lot of people who had their family, had kids, and they was getting them first.
So who were the people in the boats? Were they just neighbors?
It was all people from the military.
Okay.
It was downtown military people.
Well,
when we first escaped, we couldn't get help from no one. Well, the first time, like we was telling people we need help, no one wouldn't stop it. And that was people who was in the boats around the jail house. And it was for the jail house, I guess. At one time, we heard that they had a truck that come out to put the water, to cut the cells open for the inmates. They never had. The chaps said we called the truck and they cut the cells open, but it never happened. We still around to spend 3-4 days in the cell without eating or drinking water.
I'm glad that you survived. I'm glad that you got reunited with your family. I'm glad there's happy endings to some of the stories. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you, John.
They were digging a new foundation in Manhattan, and they discovered a slave cemetery there. May their souls rest easy now that lynching is frowned upon. We've moved on to the electric chair. And I wonder who's gonna be president, Tweedledum or Tweedledummer? And who's gonna have the big blockbuster box office this summer? How about we put up a wall between the houses and the highway, and then you can go your way and I can go my way. Agree with all the radios, and I keep hearing that same damn song everywhere I go. Maybe I should put a bucket over my head and a marshmallow in each ear and stumble around for another dum-dum week for another humdrum hit song to appear. People used to make records, as in a record of an event. The event of people playing music in a room. Now everything is cross-marketing. It's about sunglasses and shoes or guns and drugs you choose. We got it rehashed. We got it half-assed. We're digging up all the graves and we're spitting on the past. And we can choose between the colors of the lipstick on the whores, because we know the difference between the font of 20% more and the font of teriyaki. You tell me, how does it make you feel? You tell me what's real. And they say that alcoholics are always alcoholics, even when they're dry as my lips for years. Even when they're stranded on a small desert island with no place in 2,000 miles to buy beer. And I wonder, is he different? Is he different? Has he changed what he's about? Or is he just a liar with nothing to lie about? Am I headed for the same brick wall? Is there anything I can do about anything at all except go back to that corner in Manhattan and dig deeper this time? Down beneath the impossible pain of our history, beneath unknown bones, beneath the bedrock of the mystery, beneath the sewage system and the path train, beneath the cobblestones and the water main, beneath the traffic of friendships and street deals, beneath the screeching of kamikaze cab wheels, beneath everything I can think of to think about, beneath all, get out, beneath the good and the kind and the stupid and the cruel, there's a fire that's just waiting for fuel. There's a fire 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 just waiting for fuel.
There's a fire just waiting for you. There's a fire just waiting for you. There's a fire just waiting for you. There's a fire just waiting.
That was Fuel by Ani DeFranco. Next, we have a clip of Cynthia McKinney, collected by Voice of a Native Son.
Congressperson Cynthia McKinney of the 4th District of Georgia believes that she has found at least a part of the answer as to why the American government responded the way it did and continues to proceed, in this case, when it comes to the African victims of Hurricane Katrina.
Thank goodness I can come to the floor of the House and speak my piece. And as long as C-SPAN cameras are running, well, they won't be cut off, but I understand there's even an effort to try and limit C-SPAN's access to the American households. But I have to tell you something. As I saw the African-Americans, mostly African-Americans, families ripped apart, I could only think about slavery. Families ripped apart. Herded into what looked like concentration camps. And so I was reminded of a Miami Herald article written on July 5th, the day after Freedom Day, 1987. The title of the article was Reagan AIDS and the Secret Government. And here's a quote from that article. A copy of the memo was obtained by the Herald. The scenario outlined in the Brinkerhoff memo resembles somewhat a paper Giuffrida had written in 1970 at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in which he advocated martial law in case of a national uprising by black militants. In which he advocated martial law in case of a national uprising by black militants. The paper also advocated the roundup and transfer of to, quote, assembly centers or relocation camps of at least 21 million American Negroes. Now, I didn't write that. The U.S. government wrote that. They were round up 21 million Negroes because they were afraid of freeing black people. A story of neglect? I'm not surprised about any story of neglect of the people that comes from this body with this set of priorities.
Black America, put down your remote. This revolution will not be televised.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Analysis and author of numerous books on U.S. policy in the Middle East. She works closely with United for Peace and Justice and is co-founder of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. In her talk in Ann Arbor last week, she stressed how important the convergence of mass movements, global organizations, and other governments can be in challenging U.S. empire, and the important role that international organizations play in linking social movements across the globe and in making governments and international bodies remain accountable.
You discussed how the new superpower of mass movements, foreign governments, and the U.N. can act as a counterbalance to the U.S. superpower. I was wondering if first you could give an example of what you mean, and how do you see this developing in the future?
Well, I think the clearest example we have of this collaboration is the period of the run-up to the war in Iraq, when you had the emergence of this three-part global challenge to the U.S. drive for war. And it was an extraordinary moment. We know that it wasn't enough to keep the U.S. from going to war, but it did prevent the U.S. from claiming the legitimacy that it wanted for that war. And that was very, very important in terms of building global opposition. In terms of how it will come together in the future, it's very interesting. This morning's New York Times had a long analysis of how the so-called coalitions of the willing are crumbling in favor of coalitions of other countries coming together specifically to challenge the U.S. So one of the examples, of course, is the emerging collaboration between China, Russia, and India over challenging the U.S. effort to either use military force or at least impose very harsh sanctions against Iran. So there's a number of those kinds of challenges emerging. Now, I think that we have to be very clear that in general, governments are not going to have the same vantage point as social movements. But I think it does mean that more and more governments are starting to realize that for their own reasons, the role of the United States' drive towards empire is not in their interest.
What do you see as some of the best organizations that might be able to bridge that gap?
Well, I think there's a lot of organizations globally. Certainly the international organizations like the World Social Forum and the growing international peace movement, the Reclaim Our UN movement, are all playing very important roles in linking social movements in different countries. I think that's really the key. We're going to be in a position that's stronger and stronger in terms of being able to demand that governments and the United Nations stay accountable to their own stated goals, their governments' constitutions, the UN Charter. Those become instruments for us to hold up and demand their accountability to our movement's demands.
Bennis sees the first priority in challenging the global spread of U.S. empire and U.S.-led or supported occupations as withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq and renouncing permanent bases there and control over Iraqi oil. She was very positive about the impact that U.S. public opinion can have in forcing the Bush administration to renounce these goals.
I think that we're already seeing a massive change in public opinion, and that is going to force political shifts. 3 months ago, no one in Congress, no officials in Washington would say the word withdraw without whispering it and looking around to see who might be listening. Pretty soon, I think the pressure is going to reach the Republicans who are up for re-election next year. If that increases, the people around Bush, Karl Rove and his people, as ideologically driven as they are, they're not stupid. They can read the polls. And they're going to recognize the need for shifting some of the focus. There's no doubt, in my view, that the administration itself wants to withdraw massive numbers of troops. They want to keep something like 35,000-40,000 troops in Iraq permanently. They want them there to guarantee access to the oil. They want them there to have bases that will be used on a regional and global basis. But I think we have to keep the pressure on, and I think there's no doubt that the administration and Congress and others in power are going to be feeling the heat.
This is an important time for peace activists to keep getting their message out there and to keep connecting the dots between U.S. foreign policy and the drive toward war and global domination. There's more than enough work to go around, she says, and plenty of enthusiasm about getting it done.
Well, there's a huge amount of work to be done. This is, as you say, an extraordinary moment of opportunity for challenging the dual occupations in the Middle East, for challenging the overall drive towards war and empire. After September 24th, there's going to be a huge amount of work to go forward. There's going to be election work to do. On the Monday after, there will be both lobby days coordinated by a number of organizations within UFPJ and a set of civil disobedience actions, direct actions at the White House and elsewhere in Washington. And there's a lot of organizations, the Interfaith Council of here in Ann Arbor that does work on Israel-Palestine, a number of organizations working on Iraq. There's a huge amount of work to do and more than enough organizations to keep everybody busy.
For Black Box Radio, this is Chris Call.